Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So it's the full moon of October, our Pavarna day, the end of the Vasa, end of the rains retreat. And so it's time to, in the Pavarna, we make an invitation to each other for reflection or contemplation. So if there's anything that we feel we need to say to each other, there's an opening to do that if you would like, although that opening is generally understood to be there all year. But if you feel there is something you need to share with someone or indicate something to someone in the Sangha that they need to maybe be more careful of or look at, then this is a good time to receive that kind of, offer that reflection. And the way we offer reflection is to ask for permission first. So if you want to communicate something to a fellow samana, then you ask for leave to say something. Bhante or Venerable, would this be a good time? I'd like to offer you some reflection. And so offering admonishment or reflection is something that is can be done skillfully or unskillfully. It can be done in the hallway as a restless, irritated remark. Don't do that. You shouldn't do that. That usually doesn't have a very good effect. We all do it, of course. But so we try to be careful in the way we admonish or reflect or say things. I don't think we should be so weak that we can't take a hit every now and then. That would be a bit pathetic, really. But our training is to try to offer reflections in a way which is considerate, according to Dhamma. We look into our own minds. Are we pure in this? Are we clear about what we're talking about? Is it just a biased judgment, or is there some clarity in what we want to offer? Is it according to Dhamma Vinaya? Or is it just because we are the grounds for those kinds of reflections that we have with each other are based on Vinaya, Dhamma Vinaya, not just personal preferences and irritations. So if I feel irritated by someone's behavior and it's not against the Vinaya, then that's my problem. But if there's someone's behavior which is not according to Dhamma Vinaya, then it's our problem. As a group, we're always trying to train and offer reflection. And of course, it's a very helpful thing if one is given reflection in a skillful way. If another samana comes to you and says, Bhante, you know, you might not, may I offer you some reflection for you? And you sit down and talk about it and say, did you know that when you operate in this way, this is the way it affects the community? At least that's my perception. That kind of discussion takes a lot of mindfulness, a lot of courage. It's not an accusation. It's a way of trying to help each other to awaken to the way we're operating with each other. And all of us have blind spots. It's just common that we don't see things. But to realize that quite often if a person isn't maybe necessarily coming from a bad place when they behave in a certain way, quite often we think that the person's behavior is somehow deliberate and purposeful and we feel irritated by it. But then when you talk to someone, you realize, oh, that's just the way they've been conditioned by life, the way they have been conditioned through their own ego conditioning. So a good conversation explores differences of opinion, differences of view, rather than shaking the finger and saying, you're wrong, you shouldn't be this way. And that takes maturity, courage, patience, listening. So to be able to actually listen and receive reflection rather than just get defensive or jump in before the person has had a chance. To have the courage to offer reflection rather than think, oh, it's not my problem, someone else's problem. Not that I perceive any problems here. I think we're a very good sangha, and I'm pleased with the sangha. But this is the path of an hour in a day, and so that's one of the reflections we do look at the what is skillful admonishment? What is a skillful way to say to someone that this aspect of training needs looking at? And what's unskillful? Reactivity, saying nothing quite often is unskillful. So do consider that, even if you don't pick up the Pavarana invitation, just consider in our lives, how do we offer each other training in a way that this monastery functions well? Because there is much to do, and we have very high standards around mundane things like toilets and putting things away and keeping the shrine room clean and the way we wash our bowls and so on and so forth. These are very, very mundane things, but they do create an atmosphere of mindfulness. And so we need to help each other reflect on what our standards are. And the Vinaya is paired, our etiquette, our what we call kawad is paired with the transcendent teachings. And that's always important to remember, that if you only have the transcendent teaching, you wouldn't really have the bhikkhu vinaya, you wouldn't have the bhikkhu training. If you only had the bhikkhu rules and didn't have transcendent realization, you really wouldn't have Buddhism, you just have rule keeping. So remembering that both are very, very important, not to dismiss either one as being greater or lesser. So they work in tandem. When we observe good standards of behavior, good standards of speech, good standards of deportment, good standards of caring for our kutis, caring for our robes, good standards of caring for our elders, good standards for helping the junior people, when those Vinaya standards are kept, then the community has much more harmony. There's no individual regret or remorse or discord to deal with. And when those factors are there, then our meditation proceeds much more smoothly. We're not obsessed with issues with each other, and that can be very, very, to say the least, time consuming. So when we live by this common agreement, and the common agreement is imparted to us from elders, we learn this. It's not just a written agreement, I'm a bhikkhu, I'm an anagarika. It's a constant training. When we imbibe that and we discuss it and we say, well, what are our standards around computers? What are our standards around allowables? What are our standards around all manner of things? We keep coming to these agreements and living by them, then that facilitates a lifestyle for contemplation, reflection, meditative stillness, meditative calm, and insight. And that's the inheritance we do get from Lompo Cha, from Lompo Sumedho, from the Thai forest tradition, from the Vinaya itself. That's the great gift we're given, and by creating a monastery like this, of course, we have a chance to offer that back to new candidates who are interested in ordaining, and also creating a sanctuary community where people can come and feel safe, cannot be caught up with political issues, just be able to kind of let go into a situation which is wholesome, harmonious, which of course helps them in their meditation. So it's a very noble, I think, a very noble and worthy thing we're involved with. The transcendent teachings, the liberation teachings, use the Vinaya as a standard, as a method, as a as a foundation for living a social life. And then our own reflections have to somehow bring forth not just the rules of a bhikkhu, but the whole import of being a bhikkhu, to the realization of liberation from suffering. And that constant theme is something that always, I think we all always, we wouldn't be here, we keep it in mind all the time. And so each of us has our own particular themes that we're working on. Each of us have our own individual character that we're working on. And so we need a lot of compassion with each other to realize that all of us are works in progress. All of us have a certain burden of asava and kilesa, defilement, that karmically comes forward into our consciousness. And as much as we would like to be perfect, those forces sometimes are more powerful than our own ability to be mindful. When those forces are so powerful that when we step out of the bounds of Vinaya, then of course we are asked to be more careful. But often it's not a question of Vinaya, it's just a question of mood, that something in my karmic formations triggers off a certain mood of the mind, and I just have to endure it. And if the mood is negative, then you have to endure it too, unfortunately. And this is the generosity of living together as mature samanas who realize, well, there's just no way that all of us can be on our game all the time, right speech, right? You know, that we're somehow perfected beings, that we will somehow, you know, do things which are irksome and irritating and not quite on. But that doesn't mean that we deliberately do that. We're learning from our own defilements, from our own mistakes, and from our own struggle. And so somehow to allow that struggle to take place, but to keep it within the Vinaya. So the Vinaya, notice that the Vinaya doesn't ask that any of us be happy. That's not a requirement. You don't ordain. And the first parajika rule says that if you're not happy, you will disrobe. That's not the Vinaya. The Vinaya is not about the particular mood of mind you have. It's about how we can live together with the moods we have, with the karma we have. So I think forgiveness of yourself if you make mistakes, forgiveness of others if they somehow come across in ways which are uncomfortable or unpleasant, and to keep coming back to kind of a heartfelt intention to support each other in this aspiration for Nibbana, because that's where we are calling, whether we're Burmese or Latvian or Canadian or American or Thai or whatever nationality we have, whatever age we have, whatever karmic conditioning we have. Those are very, very unique, very particular, and the Dhamma tries to address those. But what our common aspiration is the realization of Nibbana, and to kind of always try to keep that in mind, that the person in front of me, that's why they're here, that's their aspiration. And how can I help this person realize that, rather than this person is someone who doesn't conform to my way of liking life to be, and therefore I won't admit them into my consciousness because they're not what I want them to be. That's a very worldly way of looking at it. And so there's a kind of real generous spirit with monastic life, that one sees that someone coming into this, or someone who's been in this a long time, still lots of defilements come out, lots of misunderstandings and missed practices come out, and to allow for that is a generous impulse, it's a compassionate impulse. And to demand that we somehow conform emotionally to something that is impossible, that's very oppressive. You know, you will be happy because you were a Buddhist monk. Or so our duties then are quite simple. We attend our ritual meetings, our group meetings. We try to facilitate the work that needs to be done. And so we fulfill our duties, but within that you can like it or dislike it. You can feel inspired about the morning meditation or feel annoyed by it. You can like to do physical work, you can dislike physical work, but you still do it, don't you? You know, I don't want to work out in the rain today, but you do it. I don't want to come and meditate this morning, you do it. And that giving up to a structure which is bigger than our own preferences, that's very liberating, because now no longer am I just trying to create ideal conditions for my own comfort or my own sense of what meditation is or spiritual life is, but I'm surrendering that to a larger possibility where we support each other. And all the forms that we have, they're pretty benign. So I might not like something, I might like something, I might enjoy the chanting, I might find it just boring. Dharma talks are boring, another Dharma talk, interesting. I want more, I want less. And that's the movement of the mind as it reacts to the various social situations that come to us. And that reactivity is something that we are constantly observing, a stream of consciousness, obviously. And that reactivity seems to be like a wave that comes onto the shore and then goes out again. And someone says something, or there's a sound or a smell or a memory comes up, and then there's an internal attitude towards that, reaction to that, thought about that, and that goes out and then evaluates, and then there's an input again that comes in. So this wave going in and going out, going in and out, going in and out. And we often misperceive the idea that somehow I am here and that input is out there, but that's actually one thing. It's like one drama. So say for instance, if someone reacts to me in a way which I find disturbing, and then there's a sense of self which comes up, why did they do that? They shouldn't have done that. Wrong perception would be, I am like this, and he is like that, and he shouldn't be like that, or I shouldn't be like that. That's wrong perception. Right perception is, this is actually one drama. This is one scenario with this as condition, with that as condition this arises, with this reactive response from a person, this reactive reaction comes in my heart. It's one thing, it's not two things, it's just one drama. It's one drama that arises and ceases as a piece. And seeing that is the way we extricate, one of the ways we extricate ourselves from personality view. And the Buddha's teaching replaces personality view with dependent origination. It takes that seeming sense of self, me and you, and sees that the type of me that arises depends on the type of you and my conditioning in all manner of things. So when I remember someone, if I have a memory of someone who was really gentle and kind and encouraging to me, a certain sense of a self arises from that, maybe, not necessarily, but maybe. And when I remember someone who I perceive to be difficult and obstreperous and unkind, then a different sense of self arises, a resentful or a confused or a revengeful sense of self arises. But actually, that's one drama. There's not two things, it's just one drama, one thing, and that's dependently originated. And when we see that, then we begin to see that where our freedom lies is not in the drama, but more like you're in the audience. You know, as a human being, we have this very strange capacity to both be on stage and be in the audience. We are both actor and witness. It's odd, isn't it? You can be having a difficult time with your body, say, let's say you're going through some difficulty with your body, and yet you can also be aware of that taking place. You can be worried about your body, or you can be worried about something you said to someone else and feel all regret and remorse and doubt about it. And that's the drama. You're the actor in that. And yet also, you can notice that you are upset, or that you are confused, or that you are worried about your health. And so we have to act, but also, if there was only acting, if that was the only thing we had possible, then there'd be nothing transcendent, there'd be no freedom. So we can also witness, we can also kind of be in the audience. And that's a way of using different kinds of perceptions. And the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha's very skillful in understanding how perceptions work in the mind, and that you can use perceptions in very skillful ways, or you can be the victim of perceptions. Perceptions build up your reality. This is a car, this is a rug, this is a clock, this is a cup, this is a tape recorder, it is evening, this is a monastery, and so on. These are just the basic building blocks of living life. If you didn't have perception, or your perceptions were distorted, you'd have some form of dementia. So perception is a kind of basic function of mentality to interpret life and to be with life. If you don't have it, you're finished. But also perception has in it, it has things like comparison. Right? So this is better than, this is bigger than, this is colder than, this is more beautiful, this is less beautiful. That's a part of perception. So it's also interpretation. So that's kind of the basic structures of a life, and there's the interpretation of life. You need that too. You need that too. You realize you cook a pot of rice and it's a bit too hard. You realize, oh, I need more water. I need more water in the rice. So your perceptions build up. They build up into the various skills that you have. How to drive a car. How to cook a meal. How to meditate. So various things. So our kind of perceptions and ideas build up. This is these kinds of activities create this kind of result. So, and then certain perceptions are assumptions. Say, you know, we assume certain things. We don't even think about it very much. I just assume this clock works. Right? I just assume it works because it's always working. And then one day it's not working. It's broken. Not working. I assume this cup doesn't leak. Right? So I just pick it up with water in it because I assume it's a whole cup. It's not broken. Right? But what happens if we have wrong assumptions? Or what happens if our assumptions are based on a certain amount of ignorance? Well, those assumptions then will create causes. So if I assume that this cup is not broken and I pour the water in and for some reason it got cracked and then I get all wet because I didn't know that, I had a wrong assumption. Hopefully when I learn it, then I'll throw the cup away and it'll keep pouring water in. So perception is very, very important. We can then use perceptions. We can use perceptions to train our lives. So you have, if you take the simple perception that the glass is half empty or half full, right? That creates effect in your mind. Half empty, that's a cliche, right? But it does create effect in your mind. Optimist, pessimist, realist, whatever you want. So I can use perceptions in the way you interpret life. So I could say that I could be critical of something, and I could also be grateful at the same time. So there's some difficulty I'm having, and I could say, life is not right. But then I could be grateful for what I do have. half full, half empty. So what kind of perceptions are we encouraged to bring forth in the Dhamma? If we go back to the idea of dependent origination, that's one of the perceptions where we are encouraged to start to make use of, that this feeling of irritation which has arisen dependent on causes and conditions. It's not essentially permanent and real and me. It's in consciousness, it's in the consciousness I'm experiencing, but it's not an essential quality. It's simply dependently originated. It depends. With this is condition that arises. When this ceases, that ceases. And that's a different way to look at your own own kind of kilesa formations and defilements and difficulties you experience. That's the way of not self. And it's not dismissing it. It's not dismissing. It's just saying, ah, with this there is that. As opposed to, oh gosh, I shouldn't have done that, or they shouldn't have been like that. That's self-view. And self-view is very pernicious. It's an assumption. It's an assumption. Like, I am a person who is defined by my history and my emotionality and da-da-da-da-da-da, and I am this and I am that. And so something arises and a sense of self arises and then I believe in that. That very assumption, the Buddhist teaching is trying to undermine by using dependent origination. And when you start to do that, and now these perceptions that we have in Buddhism are not like beliefs. I think one of the confusions people have about Buddhism, they can take the perceptions of change or not self and just think they're kind of beliefs and dismiss them. But I should think that what we're asked to do is actually use perceptions skillfully and begin to redefine the way we interpret life. And that's a very active kind of thing that we do, not a passive acceptance or belief, but you have to do it. So if I'm frightened by some situation, or literally a memory comes up of something that was unfortunate and happened to me, and then that memory triggers off a sense of resentment. When we use the perceptions of dependent origination, you have to employ that. You have to say, you have to first of all see this is a memory. That's all it is. With this memory as condition, this sense of self arises. So you're not dismissing like there's nothing there, but you just see, with this there is that. And that puts you in the perspective of seeing that this arising and ceasing is in awareness. So the wave comes and goes, but you are no longer that motion, or that motion is simply known as something that moves through you, through awareness, in awareness. And that's a perception you begin to develop too, that this situation, this emotion, this thought, these feelings are in awareness. Rather than me being this person who have these feelings against that person and I shouldn't be like that or they shouldn't be like that, that's very sticky and it's endlessly hopeless. And that's what we do when we make the wrong assumptions. We just get caught in the khandhas. We just reiterate some pattern of behavior or whatever through thinking. So we just judge ourselves, we judge others, and we're just caught in the khandhas. And we cannot realize the transcendent by being always in the worldly. So changing the perception to see that this feeling of this emotional reaction is in awareness. And what does that do? And this is dependently originated. Those are perceptions that need to be applied constantly. You have to do it. This is in awareness. And when you say this is in awareness, all of a sudden our mind has a lot of space. Because awareness has no real boundaries or definitions, you begin to see there's the space of knowing and that things arise and cease. Or if you if you take the perception of change, anicca sanya, mindfulness of anicca means what? Mindfulness of anicca sanya is not just believing in change as a kind of Buddhist standard, or it's actually applying that perception constantly to what's going on in your mind. And if you do that, if you perceive change, that's rather difficult. So if I'm upset with someone or upset with myself, and I can have enough space to see if this is happening in awareness, and I perceive change, I can't attach to anything. Because if I'm noticing change, then I can't attach. I have to just let it change. And you begin to have this sense of spacious awareness of change. Whereas desire, the desire mind always grasps the khandhas, get caught up with them, try to change them in a way which suits your desires, but of course never works, because the whole methodology is wrong, because the whole methodology is involved in the khandhas, and the khandhas are unsatisfactory. So non-grasping, non-attachment, these are also like what does that mean, non-grasping, non-attachment? What insight would you need to use that perception, non-grasping, non-attachment? When we then witness the movement of self-thinking as something that arises dependent on an input, we say, oh yeah, that's just a wave, it's come in, and then it goes out again. And that's happening in awareness. And that awareness can know the sense of self then, can know the ego arising and ceasing. So we watch and we observe. So we see you're in a situation with a lot of people and you get confused. So with a lot of people as conditioned, there's confusion. And then you go to yukuti, and then it's released. Oh, no confusion. Non-confusion with this condition that arises. So we certainly appreciate the more peaceful parts, but to use all of it, it's very, very important. So we just notice the contrast of a lot of people, a lot of sense input creates a certain complexity in the mind, let's say. And you go yukuti, and there's more like a simplicity. But maybe you stay at yukuti after a while and you get bored, don't know what to do. Restlessness. So with nothing to do, restlessness as a condition. This is all happening in awareness, stream of consciousness. So where's the freedom? The freedom is non-grasping. So our meditations that we do, seems to me, need to somehow enhance that possibility of non-grasping. So whether it's the breath, or body sweeping, or whatever you do, does that enhance the sense of non-grasping? Or does that create the grasping of tranquility? Because the grasping of tranquility then creates a sense of alienation from complexity. The grasping of complexity is indicated by the lack, the inability to be quiet, the inability to be on your own. So you need to do both in a kind of working monastery like we have. We need to be able to be alone, to sit and walk, read, study. We need to be with people, to be with complexity. And if any of that equation doesn't work for you, like if complexity, you begin to resent it and so on, or solitude is something that is difficult, then we need, each of us needs to look at why. Why can't I just be by myself? Why can't I be with people? And all of us have different characters. Some of us are better on our own. Some of us are better with people, and we have strengths and weaknesses. But we have this lifestyle which asks us to look at our own conditioning in both situations. Lots of people, no people. Lots of work, no work, whatever. So the kinds of thinking patterns that you might get caught up into, just try to notice how they are dependently originated, rather than yelling at them and getting caught up in your own khandhas even more so. Just see, oh, with this trigger, this arises. Say, oh yeah. And then step out, learn to see that this is in awareness. rather than try to always resolve things and issues with the khandhas, resolve them with non-grasping. That's the way you resolve it. This in awareness, this arises and ceases in awareness, perception of change, dependent origination, non-grasping, non-attachment. These all are pointing to the way of not trying to find yourself in the khandhas, not trying to sort out the khandhas even, because they are just not, they're just the way they are. So if one has some difficult come of fear, that's fine, it's just fear. And this is in awareness. If someone has difficult khanda of being lazy, fine. So being lazy or being fearful, it's not the laziness of fearful, it's the attachment. So if I go to my kuti and all I just tend to just crash out all the time and sleep all the time, well, that's attachment. There's nothing wrong with being lazy, but the attachment is the problem. So how do I sustain diligence and yet not reject the very feeling of laziness? So we'll see, laziness is in awareness, and then I do something, I can do things. But not to get rid of the laziness, but to see, laziness is a condition which I attach to, it does not lead to any kind of samadhi, any kind of tranquility, any kind of well-being, so I need to somehow rise above that attachment. So it's the attachment to laziness. How does that work? I investigate, I watch that. And then I see, I feel bored with meditation, or I feel distracted, or whatever. So I begin to investigate, maybe like the feeling of laziness. How does it arise? How do I react to the feeling of laziness? How does it make me go to bed? What happens if I don't go to bed? Whatever. And then, so the whole, there isn't a rejection of laziness, say, as an example. But actually there's a contemplation of that as a mood of the mind. And they begin to understand it and begin to see how to operate with it. Same with fear, same with shyness, same with moodiness, the same with excitement. There are different ways that we have, different karmic ways. So the moods of the mind will come up. If we have no perspective on them, we're just victims. We just go into these constant patterns. But to just judge yourself that you should not be restless, that you should not be lazy, and just push yourself from some kind of willful attempt to destroy the defilements, that's still ego-based. To not make any effort, that's also ego-based. So the Majjhima Patipatthā is the kind of middle way of being, knowing the mood of the mind, seeing the sense of self that's created, seeing what kind of efforts come forth, seeing the result of that. So the suggestions we have from our tradition, do lots of sitting, do lots of walking when you have a chance. These are very simple forms to observe. What's the mood of the mind? Very simple forms. Sitting, walking. When it's time to work, be diligent, be generous, help each other out. When it's not time to work, back to the kuti, study, sit, walk, very simple. The mind is complicated, our karma is complicated. So we go into a new period in the monasteries, we're in a transition period from the end of the vassa, and there's the katina time, comings and goings, and then the winter retreat, sort of, you could say, can define the end of the year, the beginning of the year, a whole different kind of pattern of life. But whatever, we keep using it for liberation from the attachment to the khandhas. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.
Annamiyam namagataya sadhu karangadamase
sadhu, 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 anumam.